The Tom Woods Show, episode 1831.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Gene Epstein is back with us today. And we're going to be talking about an article. We'll get into the details in just a minute that just got Gene very unhappy. Because if there's one thing that makes Gene unhappy, it's badly researched propagandistic articles. And boy, oh boy, are there a lot of those in this world. So we're going to be tackling one of those on the general subject of why the Democrats are allegedly better on the economy. When there's a Democrat in the White House, the economy seems to do better. We're going to unpack that. Gene, of course, is formerly economics and book review editor at Barron's. He is currently the director of the Soho Forum, an amazing debate series, and just an all-around great guy. Gene, welcome back.
Tom, it's good to be back, and I'd like to take a senior citizen's prerogative before we get to the substance of our discussion to front-load a couple of plugs, just so to make sure that I don't forget. And so if you'll allow me, I want to mention that since this is going to be a podcast that we released on Monday, and so this is a Monday that you're listening to it, and a week from Thursday, that will be February 18th, I'm going to be in the Villages, Florida, about an hour north of Orlando, about an hour north of Disney World, an hour north of the Orlando airport. And that will be a debate between John Mackey of Whole Foods and Yaron Brook of the Ayn Rand Institute. And so I hope you can all meet me down there. That will be the first in-person Soho Forum in nearly a year. And I'm looking forward to it. I know you are not going to be able to make it, Tom, but you will be there in spirit. And I hope everybody else will be there physically. And if you're going to drive down, I want to point out that you need to fill the time to listen to a podcast. Now, if you have exhausted all 1,800 plus episodes of the Tom Woods Show and then all 225 episodes of Tom Woods with Bob Murphy on Contra Krugman, which has a lot of riches, then I want to recommend the Soho Forum Debates podcast for all you podcast listeners. Now, it publishes only once every month because what we do is we publish the podcast version of our monthly debates. But we now have over 50 on file at the Soho Forum Debates podcast. And included in these one-on-one, very provocative, very dramatic debates are a number of people who've been on the Tom Woods Show. That includes, for example, Bob Murphy, Walter Block, Brian Kaplan, Martin Kulldorff, and none other than me. I've actually hogged the Soho Forum Debates podcast. I've done 6 debates out of 50, and so you can listen to my debate as well. And sooner rather than later, Tom Woods is going to do a Soho Forum Debates podcast as well. That's something to look forward to. So those are my 2 plugs, Tom, and now we can get to the substance of the discussion.
All right, very good. And I'm very, very unhappy that I'm actually going to be out of town at the time of this event. I want my people to go, and I think they don't even need any coaxing from me, because who wouldn't want to go to an in-person event at this point, especially a Soho Forum debate? Mm-hmm. We won't bombard people with information, but I'll just say that in April there's going to be another one, and yes, I will definitely be at that. You know, it doesn't matter what it takes. I will definitely be at that one.
Thank you, Tom. I look forward to you being there. And again, just going to thesoulforum.org, thesoulforum.org, and get full information on both of those debates down in the Villages, Florida. Thank you very much, Tom.
All right. Well, today we're going to talk about an article in the New York Times that you pointed out to me on the opinion page called "Why Are Republican Presidents So Bad for the Economy? GDP, Jobs, and Other Indicators have All Risen Faster Under Democrats for Nearly the Past Century."
Yeah.
Now, we got old Gene Epstein on here to explain to us that it ain't as simple as they make it seem in the New York Times, as usual. Mm-hmm. So, and now the article is citing a paper, by the way, from about 5 years ago that shows that under Democrats, there are considerably higher rates of real GDP growth than under Republicans. So, Gene, the explanations given for this in the article are, to my mind, not very convincing. So, how do you attack this?
Well, thank you, Tom. And this is indeed getting to be like the great old days of Contra Crewmen, where Tom Woods begins with a summary, and then I play my Bob Murphy role, and I tackle it and do all the economic heavy lifting in the discussion. And then it turns out that Tom told me that actually I was a guest on the 8th Contra Crewmen where we discussed this issue, and that was a number of years ago, so I don't even quite remember. But I want to start just with my own bias, Tom. And of course, I think it's more than a bias. I think it's empirically based. And we'll start this way by quoting one of my favorite lines from Adam Smith. And this apparently was in the Theory of Moral Sentiments by Adam Smith, not The Wealth of Nations, his more famous book. Smith wrote as follows, "Little else is requisite to carry a state to the highest degree of opulence from the lowest barbarism, but peace, easy taxes, and a tolerable administration of justice, all the rest being brought about by the natural course of things." Now, Adam Smith added another key sentence to that statement. "All governments which thwart this natural course, which force things into another channel, are unnatural, and to support themselves are obliged to be oppressive and tyrannical." Now, that actually should be almost the motto of the Economic Freedom Index, which I'm going to get to in due course. But I wanted that framework because when people like me, economists like me, Austrians, free market types like Tom, confront a debate between the Republicans and the Democrats, it's a little bit like the Mensheviks versus the Bolsheviks. You know, we don't really have a horse in this argument. The real reason why this stuff rubs me the wrong way is that it gets into all kinds of confused and crazy analysis that does violence to the insight of Adam Smith and the very deep and very well documented insight of the Economic Freedom Index about what makes a difference in terms of economic growth. So that's my framework. And now I want to get into the nitty gritty. As you said, Tom, the story by David Leonhardt, whom I've known for quite a while at the New York Times, purports to show that there's this huge gap in economic growth between a period when a Democrat is in the White House versus when a Republican is in the White House. Now, back in 2016, when I was writing my regular column for Barron's, I confronted this paper by economist Blinder and Watson. And of course, my hackles came up a little bit because, again, I don't know what the heck they were talking about. The guy in the White House makes all the difference. And in addition, of course, my suspicion was that what they were really doing is saying, look, the best jobs I get in government are when a Democrat's in the White House, so please vote for my candidate. I suspected them of that motivation, but it looked like on the surface as though it was some kind of decent analysis. At least that they felt that they could publish in a peer-reviewed journal. And what did they find? They found that if you take 6 Republican presidents, starting and 6 Democratic presidents, this was actually starting with Harry Truman and going up to not quite the final years of Barack Obama. This is, of course, obviously before Trump came on the scene. So a 6 versus 6, and actually it was a reasonable amount of comparable periods between the presidencies of these 6 versus 6. And they found that GDP growth under the 6 Republican presidents averaged 2.5%, and under Democratic presidents, it averaged 4.3%. So they claimed, now I'm getting into the weeds here, so follow me. They claimed that this 1.8-point gap, again, 4.3 versus 2.5, is so huge. You know, 1.8%, of course, compounded, it adds up to a lot. It's so huge that it's really worth remarking on. And so that was their big point. Now, I don't think there's much there, even on the basis of accepting those numbers. We could get into that. I don't think it leads to any interesting insights as to who's in the White House for various reasons. But they claim, my God, look at this big number. It's 1.8. So isn't that a big deal? Now, they also said in passing, it's true that when a Republican is in the White House, a recession tends to occur more often. A recession that, of course, deals in a downturn, a contraction, a negative figure for GDP. So that perhaps brings a drag on the figure. They sort of granted that in passing. So what I did at the time in 2016 was I took that record. I updated it a little bit because we had some more recent numbers for Obama. And I asked the following: what happens if you back out recessions from these periods? And I used the standard National Bureau of Economic Research business cycle dating committee figures for when recessions happen and when expansions occur. So I just backed out recessions because I did indeed notice that recessions seem to occur on the watch of a Republican president and far less often on the watch of a Democratic president. As a matter of fact, this is really inside baseball, but I can tell you that I had it on extremely good authority that when the Business Cycle Dating Committee met in 2002 to decide when the 2001 recession occurred, there was an argument between Democrats and Republicans. The Democrats on the Business Cycle Dating Committee prevailed, and they put it smack dab in the Bush administration, George W. Bush administration tenure, rather than the tail end of the Clinton tenure, even though you could argue it really occurred in the Clinton tenure. So there's even politics in the way the Business Cycle Dating Committee determines things, because they tend to favor Democrats because usually the jobs are better when Democrats are in power. That's at least my view. I'm not going to substantiate it. I just get that impression. Anyway, so what I did was, after backing out recessions from the six Republican presidents and from the six Democrat presidents, because there were indeed recessions during six Democrat presidents, I found that the figure for the Republicans in this case rose from 2.5% to 3.9%. And that for some reason, the figure for the Democrats remained at 4.3. So this gap of 1.8 percentage points, nearly 2 percentage points, shrank to 0.4. And so I decided that on that basis, you really weren't looking at anything very remarkable. And I pointed out that, of course, from an Austrian standpoint especially, that when you back out recessions, you're not necessarily eliminating the strikeouts from the batting averages. That recessions usually occur because of Federal Reserve intervention. They build up for years. I would argue, I would imagine Tom would agree, that the major 08, 09 downturn began really in the 90s with the formation of the housing bubble. The 1981-82 downturn was really the fruit of policies that began in the 1960s. And of course, the 81-82 occurred during on Reagan's watch. And so I think that really it's a little bit random as to when the recessions occur. And as I said, sometimes, at least in the 01 recession, rigged a bit. And for that reason, I just decided empirically that, look, if you're looking at 0.4 of a point, far less than that 1.8 they claim, then you're looking at nothing very interesting, especially since, and this is again something I'm going to get to in due course because we need to update these numbers in a moment, especially since the Economic Freedom Index seems to explain it far better, explain differences in performance over time far better. So I want to pause on that one, but now I could get to the New York Times, because David Leonhardt of the New York Times, who's been there for not a lot of years, economic journalist, he updated Blinder and Watson's numbers, and he found something even more striking. But perhaps you want to comment, Tom, before I get to the New York Times, because I always want to give you a chance to get in. Go ahead, Tom.
You're a good sport on the old Tom Woods show, Gene.
I'll let you get in a couple of comments, Tom. So proceed. Go ahead.
Well, yeah. What I want to say is actually about the article. He tries to speculate as to why it might be that
David Leonhardt does. Yeah.
You know, that the Republicans might be so much worse. And I'm going to give away the punchline. The one that he more or less settles on is the Democrats, I'm reading him, have been more willing to heed economic and historical lessons about what policies actually strengthen the economy, while Republicans have often clung to theories that they want to believe, like the supposedly magical power of tax cuts and deregulation. Democrats, in short, have been more pragmatic. So this is like a German historical school view of economics. Like, we don't really know what the causal relationships in the economy are, but we just know that if we observe some snapshots, that can tell us what must have worked and what didn't. Well, I'll just tell you, it has nothing to do with tax cuts per se or deregulation, both of which are good things. But in general, your approach to allowing the building up of the capital stock or tending to consume the capital stock. We want more capital, at least we want companies to be allowed to invest more per capita in terms of capital goods so as to increase people's productivity and therefore wages and real incomes. That's what we want. And there's no way that undermining capital accumulation, which is how the standard of living improves, there's no way that that can be right. That you couldn't look at sheaves of data and say, well, every time we've done that, things have turned better. Because there's so many other factors at work. There's no way, if we were burning house, you know, if we were lighting houses on fire arbitrarily, and for some reason that seemed to correlate with higher growth, that wouldn't mean that burning the house. So he's completely agnostic here. It's that, well, we're going to look at some sheaves of data. And of course, he's I would suggest, a little biased too in the way he looks at the data.
Well, a little biased, my God. Yeah, Tom. Absolutely. No. Okay. That's great what you just said, Tom. It's absolutely true as far as it goes. But you said, I didn't even go beyond what you said, but I also want to get, since I did all this homework on the empirical data.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go into that empirical data. Yes.
Okay, we'll get into it. But since you mentioned the capital stock, I only want to emphasize something else, which of course takes words out of your mouth as well, which is that it's not just a bean counter's measurement of the capital stock. It's that if you actually take any period in time, 1750 in America, 1950 in America, and if all you did was increase the capital stock, but without increasing the innovation that entrepreneurship brings, then you wouldn't have gotten very far. That really, the point beyond just accumulation of the capital stock is that you need 100 flowers to bloom, to echo Mao Zedong. You need to allow the dispersed free market to come up with good ideas that innovate. That's really the secret sauce. Because again, I always point out to people, it's very simple to understand what innovation does, because all you have to do is just say, let's take 1750 in America, 1850 or 1950, and just freeze all innovation. Assume we just have the same stuff accumulated, we would have gotten some increase in the standard of living, but nothing like the explosion of the standard of living that comes from innovation. So that too, of course, is the key point. And of course, I'm only taking words out of your mouth, Tom, by saying that, although I want to return to the Economic Freedom Index in a minute. But now I want to get back into the weeds a bit with what David Leonhardt did, because what they've got here is war paint. War paint meaning that if Blinder and Watson are saying, look, 1.8 percentage points, what a huge difference. So all I said was back out recessions and it shrivels to 0.4. So you're on shaky ground conceptually, and now your numbers are now diminished to relative insignificance. But what Leonhardt did, because this must have really excited him and it gets us into different aspects of history, is he added to those six Democratic presidents, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the 12 years, 12 plus years, a little bit plus, it was actually 12 years and 1 month, Franklin Delano Roosevelt being in power. And then on the other end, he added another relatively poor performance, which I talked about when I was last on your show. He talked about, he added Donald Trump, that the 4 years of Trump. And then, of course, on top of that, since he included everything, in effect, of course, Trump was to blame for the major recession of 2020. And so, of course, that meant Trump's numbers were lousy. So he even was able to improve on this wonderful gap that Blinder and Watson had found of 1.8 points. He found a gap of 2.2 percentage points. He writes this very provocative statement that under Democrats, the economy has expanded by 4.6 percentage points, and under Republicans, it's expanded by only 2.4. That 2.2 percentage points, he then calculates, my God, we would have twice as much income if we only had Democrats in the White House. So I did something similar with his numbers, but then I ran into something interesting empirically, and this could get us into some fascinating history about the years of the Great Depression under Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I did two attempts to take another look at the number. The first one was the same one, which was that I took, again, the NBER official numbers, and I backed out recessions. I backed out contractions. But then I did something else. I decided to take just private sector growth, domestic product, private sector growth, growth in private sector growth, domestic product. And indeed, perhaps a lot of people don't know that the official numbers of the Bureau of Economic Analysis allow you to approximate that, because from 1930 to the present, they decompose the contributions that each element of GDP makes, one of them being government. So you can easily sort of back out the contribution, negative or positive, made by government, and your net growth then is private sector. And I did that, as many might imagine, what motivated me to do that? I did that because there's so much that was bogus in the record of the Roosevelt administration, especially during World War II. I mean, I go back to having read years ago the great insights of the economist Robert Higgs, who probably has been on your show once or twice, Tom. But Robert Higgs, who did this really obviously very insightful research into what happened during World War II. And one of his key insights, by the way, about World War II and the advent of World War II and all this growth that occurred, was he actually dealt with simple numbers, and he showed that the number of people working in 1940 versus 1941, the number of people working in peacetime industry producing private sector GDP that wasn't war-related diminished. And that clearly just, you had fewer people actually producing goods that people consumed in from 1940 to 41. So clearly you must have had a decline in output, especially since there were new people. There couldn't have been any increase in productivity. So of course I remembered that key insight, because there's so much craziness that's been stated about the great success of economic growth under Franklin Roosevelt. So I used private sector GDP, and there I found that my results were actually kind of funny. I found that the 2.2% growth, the extra 4 percentage points that Leonhard had found, shrank to 0.8. That it was, again, a fraction of what Leonhard had found. Although, interestingly, I found something else, which is that when I took private sector, that looked very good for the Truman administration. It looked very good because what's interesting, that what happened after World War II, another lesson of the free market, is that during the war, the Keynesian economists were actually declaring publicly that we could not demobilize the 11 million men under arms during World War II. Why couldn't we? Because they wouldn't find jobs in the economy, and we'd have a major depression as a result. Well, actually, this is another odd quirk of history, Tom, because I myself am ambivalent about the so-called majoritarian democracy, but certainly you could say that nobody was going to listen to the economists who were going to tell the Keynesians, who were saying, you can't let those 10 million men go home to their families because it's going to bring a major depression. Well, really, in a democracy, the government had no choice. It wasn't as though you could keep them. They wanted to go home. They wanted to go home to living. And so there was a major demobilization, a major decline in government in 46, 47, and the private sector actually did quite well. So what I'm saying is that actually when I gave private sector marks to the Truman Democratic administration, that looked extremely good for Truman, which was an interesting irony. I'm getting perhaps a little bit into the weeds, but I'm saying then the major thing that you can do to Leonhard's numbers is playing the empirical game, is to say that the 2.2 shrinks to 0.8. And therefore, for private sector growth. And so for that reason, we're not really looking at anything very striking. And now, of course, we get into your point, Tom, and which I want to pick up on, which is that what follows then is this, in Leonhard's article, is this very, very sort of rambling discussion, as you indicate, of what exactly makes for successful, why the Democrats do so much better. But I want to pick up on one point, since now we're discussing Leonhard's discussion, because this is, in a way, to my mind, the most interesting one. He finds extreme success under FDR, but actually what happened, because he makes another statement, that Herbert Hoover was passive during the Great Depression. Herbert Hoover, who of course was the president, the Republican president who preceded FDR, was passive. Have you done work on this, Tom?
Yes. It's like, how many times do we have to endure this? I mean, I saw even a PBS special said that all the historians today understand that Hoover was a precursor of the New Deal in a whole bunch of ways. Yeah,
the PBS special, really?
Yeah. So, in other words, it's super mainstream now to say that Hoover, in the big scheme of things, is in the the engineer is in the progressive mold. Yeah. And we know that Tugwell said that we just extrapolated from what Hoover was doing. And then you have John Nance Garner running for VP with FDR saying that Hoover's taken us down the road to socialism. I mean, why would he have said that if there was absolutely nothing to go on?
Passive, yeah. No, indeed. I first encountered years back when I was on my campaign of reading every Austrian work I could find, reading Murray Rothbard's book on the Great Depression. That's when I first learned about Hoover, the interventionist. And in particular, I was a little surprised that Leonhard at the Times could write this again, quote unquote, Hoover was passive in the face of the Depression. Because as you indicate, Tom, I thought that it had sort of become mainstream by then. You're saying there was a PBS documentary on the Great Depression which admitted that Hoover
I don't remember what the subject of the documentary was, if it was the Depression or it was on Hoover itself. But I can even, because I found the transcript recently. Online.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
It's amazing that he could repeat that howler. And of course, again, he's taking, obviously whatever stick he can beat a Republican with, he uses. Because indeed, I thought when I came across the NBER working paper by UCLA economist Lee Ohanian, I actually put out a couple of tweets about Leonhard's article. And I thought, well, I'm not going to cite Murray Rothbard, who in fairness is the person I should have cited, because Rothbard wrote something that surprised me especially, that what Lee Ohanian actually documents quite well, which is that Hoover was a main problem, which the main sin of turning what was probably would have been a mild recession into a major downturn was his intervention in the labor markets. The crazy idea, the sort of like, I guess it's called the consumptionist fallacy, the crazy idea that in order to prevent a downturn, you have to make sure that wage rates don't decline. You have to make sure that you hold the line on wage rates, which is exactly, of course, the opposite of what had happened, for example, in the early 20s in order to stave off recession. If there's obviously bankruptcies and the economy is turning down, then the price of labor will adjust and you won't have massive unemployment. But Hoover very proactively did the opposite. And certainly Lee Ohanian, who responded to my tweet, by the way, retweeted it and put out a reference to his peer-reviewed article. Ohanian adds some color to the story about Hoover's campaign and how, I mean, Ohanian said, who caused the Great Depression? Hoover. He has that one sentence, Herbert Hoover. So I would have thought that that's fairly mainstream, but apparently not. And of course, on top of that, the Smoot-Hawley tariff, which I think to some degree supply-siders, those people called the supply-siders, blame it maybe excessively for the major depression that occurred. But of course, the Smoot-Hawley tariff certainly hurt. And that, of course, the Smoot-Hawley tariff, which of course was a response to a downturn. We've got to make sure we have tariff barriers so we can't buy imports. And that, of course, destroyed the economy over 1,000. And that was signed under Hoover. So that was another one. The Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which they wanted to bring back in the 80s. I kept asking people a quiz. Who do you think signed that into law? That was Hoover. So again, I thought that was pretty well known. So that was kind of funny. But indeed, he writes that as well. But I want to get, in a way, to the key oddity about Leonhard's point. It's this kind of like rambling and inchoate discussion about why are the Democrats so much better? Because there's so many codicils, there's so many exceptions. He has to admit that under Clinton did exactly the opposite of what is supposed to happen, did is in a way a misnomer, because basically what happened under Clinton was that the Economic Freedom Index rose in part because government shrank. Government shrank because of factors beyond Clinton's control, Bill Clinton's control. Number one, Hillary Care was defeated, and so there would have been terrible stuff to come had Hillary Care not been defeated. That was, of course, Hillary's version of Medicare for All. That was defeated. The Cold War ended, And so there was an obligatory closing of bases, military spending declined. And on top of that, under Clinton, the Contract for America, Newt Gingrich, took control of Congress, of both houses of Congress, by 1994 and continued through Clinton's administration. And so spending declined. But he sort of credits Clinton with his creative declines in spending, showing that Democratic presidents are always so agile and always so much better at making sure they accommodate economic growth. But the key one I want to quote, which to my mind is almost the most subtle howler, is this about Franklin D. Roosevelt. He writes, "Above all, though, Roosevelt called for, quote, bold, persistent experimentation, unquote. As he explained, quote, take a method and try it. If it fails, admit it frankly and try another. But above all, try something." Now, in a way, you might regard this, I regard this as the worst howler, but only, but I don't necessarily say it's totally ignorant. It's only ignorant in the sense that it doesn't acknowledge the possibility that the free market economy, when a blow occurs, when malinvestment occurs, that there's a possibility that the free market economy can reorient and can recover just as it did in the early 20s, which has been amply documented. That prior to the Great Depression, we had downturns, but the economy recovered much faster. But in particular, to put a fine point on it, what Leonhardt, I would almost say to him personally, I would say to him, doesn't it occur to you that when a government is trying everything, trying something, that it can actually do harm? Are you really going to believe that anything the government does, whatever it might be, can only do good? It can't slow the recovery. It can't do any damage? I mean, that, to my mind, is the most subtle howler, and in a way why I sort of despair of trying to teach these people some sort of respect, some sort of orientation of respect toward what the free market can accomplish. So I'm going to stop there and see what you wanted, how you may want to elaborate on these points. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, the word despair occupies a central role in the economist's vocabulary, I think.
Yes.
Especially
yes.
in this day and age.
Yeah, yeah.
But the idea that we have to be completely agnostic as we approach economic questions, because any relationships might hold. So let's see what party's in charge when they, I mean, yeah. It's a juvenile approach.
Yeah.
And incidentally, it's not to say that what he wants to take from this, of course, is that the Democrats tend to do X and the Republicans tend to do Y. But even that's not that simple.
Yeah. No,
sometimes the Republicans do X.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's why the Freedom Index is so important,
yeah.
and not just taking Republican for proxy for free market.
Yeah, indeed. The ironic story and interesting story about Clinton, Bill Clinton, is that he was in terms of the record of spending by the federal government, he was a fiscal conservative. And what's funny about him is that by the time that federal government was briefly showing fiscal surpluses, he started to take credit for it, even though it's difficult to grant him any credit given the factors that I mentioned that put him into this corner. But there was that interesting, ironic moment in time when he wanted a locked box for Social Security, and Al Gore was echoing this point as well. And then George W. Bush wins, and suddenly spending is accelerated, and there was no interest in the locked box for Social Security. So again, that's part of the irony that you and I as libertarians, as free market types, are free to hand out certain ironic congratulations to Democratic presidents and sometimes to Republican presidents. We're agnostic on the subject. You know, it's the Mensheviks versus the Bolsheviks. Some of them do harm. They do harm on balance, but sometimes they do some good. And that gets me, in a way, to the Economic Freedom Index, because the broad story about this five-part index is that it starts in 1970, which is too bad. Would have been interesting to have more history on it. And it did rise from 1970 to 1980, from 1980 to 1990, from 1990 to 2000. 2000 is when it started to decline. And that more or less does explain the pattern of economic growth of the U.S. And in particular, it does mean that we can point out that there was initiatives for deregulation under Jimmy Carter, the Democratic president. It does mean that Clinton respected free trade more than, for example, Donald Trump did. Although it does mean that we can point out that respect for property rights. We wonder why it declined under Obama. And the numbers in particular for any all of these things are very objective. And because they're objective, you sometimes don't quite know what was causing the objective decline in the number, in particular property rights. And the best explanation I got from the people at Fraser for what happened under Obama was that when the bailout of Chrysler and General Motors happened under Obama, bondholders got screwed. The basic rule of property rights, which is that bondholders get paid first, got abrogated. And that message that was sent to the bond markets reverberated. And that's perhaps why respect for property rights declined in terms of the objective numbers under Obama. And so, again, the problem with this analysis by Blinder and Watson, the problem with the analysis by Leonhardt of the New York Times, as you indicate, Tom, and as I reflect, is that we have a reasonably good understanding of what makes for, what encourages economic growth. As you put it, capital accumulation, as I put it, add to that, you allow entrepreneurship and innovation to occur. And then the Economic Freedom Index, which is done for over 180 countries, which shows that empirically, if you take the record of these 180 countries, then there have been about 60 peer-reviewed studies done, that there are two basic insights you get, that levels of prosperity correlate with levels of economic freedom, and trends in economic growth correlate with the trend in the Economic Freedom Index for a particular country. It applies especially to China. For example, the Economic Freedom Index rose starting in the late 1970s in China, and that's when economic growth took off with the liberalization of the economy in China. So we have all of these insights empirically based about what brings about economic success, and we have, unfortunately, the myopia of the New York Times and the myopia of Blinder and Watson, which looks for it as to who, which particular party is in power in the White House. And so that's the regrettable fact about this kind of research. And I guess that's all I have to say about that, Tom. Although I wanted to mention something about tax cuts, which harkens back to what we were discussing the last time I was on the show.
Hey, everybody, let me just get a word in here to thank our sponsor, Merck Research. I am sure many of you are tired of hearing there's going to be a stock market crash just around the corner every day for the last 10 years. Well, our friends over at Merck Research provide unbiased monthly analysis on the economy and stock market. And through a consistent set of easy-to-read charts and frameworks with written analysis, these monthly reports provide an intellectually consistent view on the market and economy. You can download the PDF chart books with analysis or watch the video voiceover walkthrough. Their goal is to help you better understand what's really going on and ultimately to help you make better investment decisions. Almost all financial media, like all media, has become fear-mongering clickbait. And if you're tired of the nonstop and inaccurate doom and gloom and want an objective and insightful summary of what's going on in the market and economy, go to tomwoods.com/research for a no-risk 3-month free trial. And it's only $20 a month after that. So for your no-risk 3-month free trial, check it out at tomwoods.com/research.
Do you want to help summarize my insight, Tom?
Well, what I want to just add to it is that politics enters into this in that Republicans will do things under a Republican president that they would be fighting tooth and nail under a Democrat president.
Yeah.
So if the Republicans under a Democrat president help to keep the Democrats from their worst instincts, that will benefit the Democrats. Mm. Under the Republicans, when they carry out the spending and all the other stuff that they secretly want, then they have to suffer through that. So again, I think that complicates it, that under Democrats, if the Republicans have any form of resistance at all, they're going to actually sometimes live up to their principles, but they don't live up to their own principles under Republican presidents. That's my point. And that can twist the results.
Absolutely. And of course, we could even bring in, was it Michael Malice who originated the line that beyond that nuance, of course, when it comes to foreign policy, whoever you vote for, you get, what's his name? John McCain.
that's old Woods here. He came up with that.
Oh, that's you. Okay, Tom, forgive me. I didn't mean to take
one of people attribute things that Michael, Dave, and I say. They attribute them all promiscuously to each other just to confuse people.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Tom, I got to do you justice. You were the one who said that. So they all tend to do that. And indeed, that's where Adam Smith was saying that, you know, peace matters, because indeed, we do really spend a lot under the military, and it is indeed wasted. And all of that military spending was credited to FDR during World War II. But saner heads know that, you know, even if it's a necessary war or an aggressive war, it's not really productive spending. And so that's bad too. But of course, look, you're absolutely right that we have all kinds of interesting, obviously, it's a colorful story to talk about what happens under different presidents. And part of the story I like to cite that's, I think, at least the most interesting is that both the increase in military spending that's credited to Reagan started under Jimmy Carter, who was just prior to Reagan. And on top of that, the deregulation that people tend to think started under Reagan actually started under Carter. For example, the deregulation of the Civil Aeronautics Board. The Civil Aeronautics Board was maintaining this cartel of airlines, and people of limited means couldn't afford to fly. It was basically the age of Pan Am. And it was noticed by Teddy Kennedy, Democratic president of all people, the thing that was staring you in the face, that because the Civil Aeronautics Board had no power over flights within a state, that it took half as much money to fly from Los Angeles to San Francisco, about the same distance as to fly from New York City to Boston. Half as much money. So these awful competing capitalists were charging half as much within a state, but because of the Civil Aeronautics Board, the price was twice as much, maintained by a cartel. And so then once you deregulated the airlines, then suddenly its contribution to economic growth exploded, because now suddenly people of limited means could afford to fly. So one would think that that's fairly simple, a lesson in what free market economics can do if you get the government out of the way. And of course, I guess it harkens back to the depredations of crony capitalism, or what I occasionally like to call crapitalism. All of those very fairly obvious lessons should be well understood. But as I say, I like the nuance and the irony that that deregulation started under a Democratic president. And so we have the advantage, you and I, Tom, and others, free market, of handing out rewards and punishments and penalties and respecting different presidents. And we don't care too much whether they're Democrats or Republicans, although you're certainly right that there are certain patterns with respect to how a Republican are going to behave when the Democrats are in power and vice versa. All of those ironies also apply, and it's an interesting and colorful story. But at the end of the day, it's Adam Smith's insight that applies: easy taxes, peace, and just a tolerable administration of justice, and the free market will deliver. And that's the story. I wanted to mention something about tax cuts, Tom, because I think this is an interesting nuance. When I was last on your show and I was talking about the issue of Trump's tax cuts came up, I do want to say that when you say tax cuts are always a good thing, in a way, I don't necessarily disagree with that, but I do want to introduce, actually, I associate this with Milton Friedman, who said, when is a tax cut not a tax cut? It's not a tax cut when it's not accompanied by a spending cut, when it's accompanied by a spending increase. And so I think that we get into a rather interesting, nuanced discussion when we talk about Trump's tax cuts in particular. For example, when you cut taxes, but then you don't cut spending, spending increases. And I would say, in terms of a framework, in terms of the bottom line, the tax that government imposes on us, whether through actual taxation, whether through borrowing, or whether especially through the printing of money, that's measured by the claim it has on our resources, and that's best measured by how much it spends. And so in a way, I would say that a cut in taxes really should be synonymous with a cut in spending. And I believe that that's an important point to make, because when people talk about the Trump tax cuts, Milton Friedman's insight applies. I'm sure that Austrians would say the same thing. If spending is increasing, it's a very different kind of tax cut from when a tax cut is accompanied by a spending cut. So I wanted to include that as my footnote to my last discussion of the performance of Trumponomics.
I just love that Gene is as on a Saturday morning as he is at any time in his life. So,
thank you, Tom. And appreciate that. Yeah, I should have been. I was going to make a dumb joke. But Tom, I'm flattered that you feel that way. And it's always fun to be on your show. And again, I I hope to see everybody down in Florida. And Tom, what I want your assignment, Tom, is to send me confidentially debates that you would like to have and whom you would like to have them with. Because, again, some inside baseball story. I hosted a debate back when I was managing something called Junto. Tom actually thought it was a debating society. What Tom didn't realize about Junto was I was the one who brought the debates to this debating society run by a philanthropist and trader, Vic Niederhofer. So I hosted a debate with Tom and Michael Malice. And it was fun. It was about Alexander Hamilton being the exemplar of freedom. And Tom won that debate fair and square. And
taking the negative.
Taking the negative, exactly. And then I hosted, then on the Contra Cruz, I hosted a debate between him and Bob Murphy on pacifism. And I have to say, look, if you listen to that debate, I recommend listening to it. It was a lot of fun as well. Tom began to almost throw in the towel. He almost began to say, "What? I love what Bob is saying, and I think it's okay if Bob wins this debate." So I got to grant that, Tom. You lost that debate, but you lost it partly because you just your love for Bob and admiration for Bob Murphy.
Well, I joked about it at one point. I said, look, I know you're going to be tempted to vote for Bob because, you know, he makes some good arguments. And plus, you're thinking, why should Woods win all the debates?
Exactly. So that's why you lost that one. But anyway, then Tom and Michael Malice, to go back to that story, Tom had Michael on the show. They said, what else should we debate about Ayn Rand and all the rest of it? We got to think of some debates. But then I wrote Tom a couple of times and Tom said, I think I'm retired from debating for the time being, for the near future. But then I don't know, maybe Tom felt a little bit bad that he wouldn't participate in a Zoom debate. Anyway, long story short, so to speak, to use the old Jewishism, is that Tom said he will appear in an in-person debate if we can come up with a good one. So Tom, I want to, think about some good ones for you, but I'd love you to think about, just jot down a piece of paper.
Yeah, I'll try and think of some. Right now, yeah. I really, Mark Skousen's going to kill me. There is going to be a Tom Woods Day at Freedom Fest this year, and I have not given him what he needs on that, which is, want to do these things.
I have some ideas for that, Tom.
And let's talk. Let's talk off the air. In fact, before let's wrap up here, and then don't go anywhere, because once we stop recording, I want to tell you something.
Yeah, I'd love to tell you something, some inside story about that. But Tom, don't you have a lecture? Because my guy helped with the Eventbrite tickets for sale of a lecture you're delivering in L.A. shortly?
Oh, yeah, I'm doing an event in the episode that hasn't aired yet, but that's airing before this one, was with Mark Skousen, where we talk about the event. But yes, I'm coming out to San Juan Capistrano, not too far from Irvine, March 2nd. It's Murray Rothbard's birthday. So Mark and I are doing a little event there that I think will, I hope, boost people's spirits. And I made a redirect link. So tomwoods.com/MarkTom, and Mark is spelled with a K, that takes you to the Eventbrite page. Thank you to your team for helping us get the Eventbrite up quickly.
Sure. And when's that going to be?
That's March 10th. I beg your pardon, not March 10th. Sorry, March 2nd. I was looking at the...
Okay, I'll be
there. It's 10 smackers to get in, but it's March 2nd.
Yeah, 10 smackers, and I'll be there in spirit, Tom, and that sounds great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, okay, that's terrific, and I'd love to talk to you about what you might do for Tom Woods Day.
Okay, good. All right, so we have some secret stuff to talk about that there isn't a high enough listener level at supportinglisteners.com for them to qualify for to hear whatever it is we're about to say. So anyway, thank you, Gene.
Sure.
Okay, folks, first of all, remember, save the date, October 16th, 2021. That's the day we're having the big 2000th Tom Woods Show episode live event in Orlando. We'll be recording the 2000th episode at that event, but it's going to be a big, big episode that goes on a long time with a lot of entertainment in it and with a lot of your favorite guests from the Tom Woods Show as part of the program. I'll be revealing more details coming up soon, and I'll have a sign-up page. It doesn't cost you anything to attend, but just I'd like to get a rough sense of how many folks are going to be there. So I'll have a page up. I'll let you know about that and the details. But right now, the broad details you need to know are simply October 16th, Orlando, Florida. And it's going to be absolutely fantastic. Even sooner than that is an event I'm doing March 2nd, Murray Rothbard's birthday. He would have been 95. An event I'm doing not too far from Irvine, California, San Juan Capistrano, alongside our friend Mark Skousen. And I would love to have you there. You got to get a ticket. There are only so many tickets we can sell. And it's just to cover the expense of the venue. I mean, nobody's getting rich on this. I'm paying my own way even just to go out there. But I thought it would be a good thing to do. A lot of people are probably desperate to socialize, and we're going to have a good time. So March 2nd, 2021, get the details on that at tomwoods.com/marktom. Mark is spelled with a K. So all one word, tomwoods.com/marktom. All right, that's it. Tomorrow, Eric Brakey's coming on the show. You know Eric possibly from previous appearances on the Tom Woods Show, but also from his debate recently with Dave Smith about whether the GOP or the LP is the way to go. We're going to hash that out a bit and continue that conversation tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.